Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Part of Governor John Carney's budget proposal is new taxes on e-cigarettes and vaping products. We look at those taxes and how vaping businesses are reacting. The Blue Rocks celebrate 25 years of minor league baseball on the Wilmington Riverfront this year.
You see people now who came here as kids who now are bringing their kids. It's all about the family atmosphere. And you see people in the community like, oh, I love bringing my kids there. It's a great place to go. It's fun. I can let them run around. That's what is most important to us.
We sit down with members of the Blue Rock staff to talk about the club's past and present. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also examine the suddenly hot first aid housing market, meet a pair of high school students organizing a March for Science later this month, and learn about art forgeries in our latest arts playlist. The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground, is next. But first, the latest news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. E-cigarette retailers could soon come under Delaware's sin tax system for the first time, as the state faces a projected $386 million budget shortfall. But vape shop owners fear such a move could significantly cut their profits or put them out of business entirely. Delaware Public Media political reporter James Dawson has more.
Yeah, my flavor is not as strong as a sweet flavor as I expected it to be. So can I try that jackfruit one?
Yeah, man.
The walls of Delaware Vapor are lined with hundreds of bottles of e-juice, liquid nicotine, and any flavor you can imagine that you pour into a handheld machine.
They all just do the same thing. It applies heat through a metal coil and then applies that heat to a saturated wick, and that produces your vapor.
That's Brendan Stiles, the store's operations manager. Governor John Carney's proposed budget would add all e-juice under the tax code, charging retailers a 30% wholesale fee. As it's currently proposed, Stiles says 30% is far too high to suddenly drop on business owners, but he says he and others are willing to chip in.
With a good definition, 15% is totally doable. I don't think we'd even have to, you know, get excited about that. It would just be doing our part, you know. I mean, look at this budget deficit. We understand.
Stiles notes the 30% tax wouldn't shut down either his Claymont or Newark locations, but it would significantly affect his profit margins. For the past decade, e-cigarettes have been propelled from their early beginnings as a niche subculture to commanding $8 billion worth of global trade in 2015. It's projected to grow to more than $27 billion worldwide by 2022, and states, including Delaware, have been looking to tax the fledgling industry. State Representative Deborah Heffernan, who's been one of the main drivers behind recent vaping regulations, says there has to be some kind of tax on these products.
In some ways, like, there should be more equity with cigarettes so that kids are not attracted to buying the lower-priced other tobacco products.
Heffernan says she and others are looking into other alternatives and may not ultimately settle on a wholesale tax, but she wouldn't elaborate on possible options. Stiles, the vape store owner, says his fear is that Delaware will adopt a tax policy similar to one in Pennsylvania enacted in 2016. About 140 vape shops have closed since the Keystone State implemented a 40% wholesale tax in October. That's according to Charles Huff, president of the Pennsylvania Vape Association. They also levied a one-time 40% fee on all existing inventory. Huff says the results have been devastating for his industry.
Most of the shops that I personally have talked to have indicated a reduction in sales somewhere between 40 and 50%. And many of those shops have had to lay off staff.
He and other pro-vape advocates have picketed the Harrisburg Capitol building since the law went into effect. Instead, they want a flat tax on the volume of e-liquid stores buy. Huff's warning to Delaware officials is that such a heavy-handed wholesale approach may not help them fill the projected $386 million budget gap as much as they think.
You're either going to kill the industry or you're going to severely cripple it, and you're not going to get the money that you projected that you would get at 30%.
State officials say a 30% tax on e-cigarettes would raise about $200,000 next fiscal year, doubling in 2019. Carney's plan would also hike Delaware's cigarette tax by $1 per pack and include all other tobacco products like snuff and chewing tobacco under the same 30% wholesale fee. Combined, the state would take in an extra $16 million annually. No bill has been introduced so far, and until then, Brendan Stiles from Delaware Vapor says he's anxiously awaiting a fleshed-out proposal.
We are a part of the community. We already are. And we want to be, you know, we want to do our part and help, you know, the state out in any way we can, you know, but We just want to make sure that if there's going to be a tax on something that's clearly trying to help people, it's a reasonable tax.
James Dawson, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, James. And the Green continues in just a moment with a look at what's causing the first aid housing market to heat up this spring. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. It was a decade ago that the housing bubble burst, depressing the housing market and sparking a foreclosure crisis. And since then, home sales have struggled to recover, slowly making their way back in recent years. But this spring, the housing market here in the First State appears to be heating up again, as sellers find themselves receiving multiple offers and often getting asking price or more. So we asked contributor Eileen Dalabrida to look into what's going on with home sales, and her piece is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. She also joins us again this week on The Green to let us know what she found. Eileen, thanks for being back with us again on The Green.
Good to be here, Tom.
Well, there are no official numbers yet on how bullish the housing market is, but the anecdotal evidence seems pretty strong. What did realtors you talked to tell you about how things are going?
Well, at least in some parts of Sussex County, it's the hottest spring in 40 years, and we are seeing a lot of activity in Newcastle County as well. Things aren't quite as hot in Kent County, but we are seeing BOFO business elsewhere in the state. North Wilmington is very hot. There isn't enough inventory to meet the demand. The resort communities in Sussex County are also seeing a lot of activity, and Newark is also doing very well.
You also note in your piece that certain price ranges seem to be a bit more active. Which are the price ranges that seem to be generating the most interest this spring?
Anything below $400,000 seems to be attracting a lot of interest. And in the $200,000 to $300,000 range, it's hot as a $2 pistol.
So is it fair to assume that that means that there's a lot of first-time home buyer action going on this spring?
There is, especially among millennials who have been renting, sitting on the fence. They seem to be sparking the entry level this time around.
And there seems to be some contributing factors to this sales surge, a couple of them, starting with interest rates, right?
I think interest rates are playing a major role. The rates now are a percentage point higher than they were a year ago, and people are realizing that those very cheap rates aren't going to last forever.
What else seems to be driving sales locally?
Well, I believe that one of the things that is driving sales is that the pool of would-be buyers is expanding. The people who were renting are buying, and plus the move-up buyers who might have gotten a smaller place, downsized, or rented, are moving up.
And yeah, I guess there's the thought that perhaps this type of market could lead to another housing bubble, but there is one difference this time, and that is that loans are not as easy to come by as they were previously. Is that something that's the kind of maybe keeping this thing from really overheating?
I think so. The government is very strict about buyers demonstrating an ability to repay those loans.
In talking to the people you spoke to for the story, was there anything else that stood out to you about the dynamics of what's going on this spring that maybe is unique or unusual than what we've seen, particularly in recent years?
Well, buyers are accustomed to being in the driver's seat, and they would look at properties, and they would think about it, and maybe make a lowball offer and circle back. That is changed. In that very hot price range, 200 to 300,000 and 300,000 to 400,000, they are having to make decisions very quickly. And we are seeing situations where there are multiple offers and the sellers are getting close to, if not their asking prices.
So if someone is looking to buy now, what's the advice that you're hearing from realtors about what people should do and their expectations if they're trying to jump into this market right now?
Well, first of all, they need to get their financing completely solid because they won't have an opportunity to get a cursory pre-approval and then circle back and firm things up. If they want to come in with a strong offer, they want to come with a firm offer, they need to get their financing in place before they start looking.
And because loans are a little bit harder to come by right now and to get, that process isn't as easy as it used to be either, right?
Well, you should expect to have to provide between 12 and 24 months worth of documentation in terms of pay stubs and tax returns. One thing that is a little different is that self-employed people are having a bit easier time of it. They because they only have to demonstrate that they have steady deposits into their bank accounts.
Is there a sense that this kind of hot market is going to continue for the foreseeable future?
I think so. I think that there are a lot of buyers who are coming off the sidelines and a lot of people who are feeling better about moving up, although the higher end of the market is still very challenged. Anything above $400,000 is a tough sell, and anything above $700,000 is a very tough sell.
All right. Eileen Dalabria, thanks so much for your time this week.
Thanks, Tom.
And a reminder, Eileen's story on the First State housing market is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. The Green continues in just a couple of moments. But first, a look at your local headlines from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Newark Charter High School students Vaishnavi Koshchisharov and Dunya Ramadan are among those worried the Trump administration's attitude toward accepted scientific facts and theories puts their world and future at risk, especially when it comes to climate policy. So they've teamed up with the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Newark to plan a Newark-based March for Science on Earth Day later this month, joining similar marches planned around the country. This week, Delaware Public Media's Katie Pikus sat down with Koshchisharov, Ramadan, and Ann Green of the UUFM to talk about the march and why science matters.
Vaishnavi, talk about what made you so interested in the subject of science itself.
Personally, I've always loved scientists. Both my parents are scientists. We live in Delaware, of course, and we see these huge factories with these huge plumes of toxic chemicals, and even though you don't know what they are, you know they're bad. So I just one day asked my dad, what are these? And he gave me a huge lecture about CFCs and the ozone. And the ozone layer depletion is really what catalyzed me to read up about the environment and read up on environmental legislation. And so because we only have one Earth, and it's not a partisan issue, we all share the same Earth. So that's what got me interested in science, specifically environmental science, just the carelessness that we all seem to be having with our Earth and the throwaway society mentality that we seem to have adopted. And also, more recently, the lack of evidence-based policy, which is one of the tenets of the March for Science. Science is not disputable. Yes, there are changes in theories and all of that, but you can't dispute facts. And so that just, I think, rejuvenated the American people about the importance of science and adhering to science and believing and aligning yourself with science.
And Dunya, tell me about what sparked your interest in science as well.
So for a long period of time, I've always wanted to become a neurologist, and I've always been interested in the science field. But after the new federal administration's policies regarding the environment, such as the Dakota Access Pipelines construction, and with the EPA budget cuts, it kind of got to me that our environment, it might be in peril because after all of these years, we haven't really paid attention to how much these things actually matter to protecting our environment. And basically, without science, we cannot necessarily live on the planet. We cannot progress in the world because how are we going to take care of our health? How are we going to keep our water clean and make sure that our water won't be contaminated in the future? How are we going to do this and that? And so science is the foundation of basically all of us. We need to keep our environment clean. We need to make sure that our science professionals are kept in the highest conditions. So that's why I've always had a sparked interest in science, and the federal administration kind of, they woken up some kind of spirit inside of me, and it made me more, I guess, more active in the whole science field.
And Anne, for you as well, talk about your interest in science.
One of the things that's important to me is for people to realize how much science touches every single bit of their day. You know, when you look around, I mean, you get in a car and you drive. Well, the car, there's a lot of science in a car, right? There's how the engineering of how the wheels turn. There's the chemistry of how the fuel works and the oil. Just anything that you do during the day is related to science. And so if you're basing what you're going to do next, what you're going to develop next, you want to base it on fact, and science is involved in it.
Vaishnavi, the fact that you two are organizing the march as high school students, what are some of the things that you've learned in your classes that have made you more passionate about science?
Well, this year, I think, very fortuitous, but I finally got into the environmental science class because it's a new class and scheduling was a huge ordeal. But before, I think science is really stressed, and I think people often talk about the drawbacks of having a STEM-oriented education. It's great for the length of our humanity and all of that. People talk about the drawbacks of it, but I think the STEM orientation, especially in our school and the school I used to go to before high school, really aided me in seeing the importance of science. And like Anne was saying, science is literally in every aspect of our life. There isn't a part of our lives that aren't impacted by science. But I think with, like Dunia was saying, with the new kind of society we're living in, that in conflation with the STEM orientation really helped me, at least personally, be invested in science. And also the fact that we're teenagers and we're with, like, all of our peers are more opinionated now than they were maybe 2 years ago. They care about things. Being open to such different viewpoints and so many of them and the intensity of them really helped me invest myself in science and really made me more aware of how science is part of literally every facet of our lives.
And Dunia, same question.
I have a feminist club in school for women's rights, and this all kind of ties back into science because all of my teachers throughout the past years, they have told our classes that there needs to be a rise in women in science. And because of this, I geared my thoughts towards becoming this kind of doctor in the future to go down that path that not many take. So with all my teachers' input in terms of telling us about how people are needed in the science field in order to make our society better and in order to make the society progress in the future.
Can all three of you, starting with Vaishnavi and going to Dunia and then going to Anne, tell me how this march really came together?
So initially, like as the founder of the Environmental Club, I felt with the new membership we had because of the new political climate, it would be a great idea to utilize that manpower to make a change. Because the club is all about the science, environmental science, but also environmental advocacy and consciousness. So I thought a rally would be a really good encouragement and motivation for the members of the club to see we can make a change, and making that change regarding the environment will literally change the world. So I reached out, like I said, the teacher we talked about, Miss Lunsford, and she told me that Dunia was already thinking about a march for science.
Yeah, so basically I'm the co-president for our feminist club at our high school, and after the election I started becoming very active, and therefore, I created my own civil rights group called the Huddle for Justice. We meet every month and we discuss issues that need fixing in terms of the policies that have been enacted that we deem full of injustice. Our last meeting, a couple months ago, we discussed creating the March for Science because that's coming up nationally. And we said we need to advocate for science as well in our own community, in our own state. We need to take that stand. Therefore, my leaders and I for the Huddle for Justice, we decided we're going to take action. And our advisor, Ms. Tammy Lunsford for our feminist club, she led me to Vaishnavi, who was also planning on doing it as well. So we decided to collaborate together and promote our love for science in terms of creating a March for Science. And then
what happened? Unitarian Universalists have a history of working to create positive change in people and in our world, and we were looking at doing this with the Science March. I've never met a Unitarian Universalist who doesn't love science and the Earth. So what we thought was, well, okay, let's get organized, and maybe since we managed to kind of pull off hosting the Women's March, let's kind of do this, but we wanted, again, to put a spin on it for families and stuff. The social justice group said, okay, well, let's get going. We'll do this march. And I went to register to do the march. And then I got an email back that someone had already registered. And these two lovely ladies had already taken the lead on this. And so we decided that instead of just doing a separate march, which wouldn't make sense at all, that we would instead support them by offering them the space, by offering them help with logistics like getting the permit and things like that. And so that's how we came together to work together.
Vaishnavi, why does science matter in Delaware?
There's so many common myths that go around that have now become faux facts about climate change, about pipelines, about all this just nonsense. And the fact is, science is fact. And so it's really important for us to remind ourselves that science is not partisan. And there isn't, that you can disagree or agree, but science is a fact.
It's not an opinionated issue, to be honest, because it's a fact. Climate change is real.
Yeah, like 97% of the world's scientists say climate change is happening right now. It's not only happening, it is slowly killing us. So again, that evidence-based policy aspect is really important for this march to remind not just us, like we were talking about before, but also those who are supposed to be representing us, that we align ourselves with science, America aligns ourselves with science, and that not believing in climate change is not an okay thing for the highest power to be able to say. It's not an okay thing for government officials to be saying. Pipelines that will probably leak, that's not an okay thing to approve. These, and like these rollbacks, executive order, like, in my opinion, it's a travesty, and it highlights the concern that those in power might not be representing us, and that our best interests aren't their best interests, which is an issue. But again, this idea of science being nonpartisan is just a theme we keep revisiting, because I feel like if we remind everyone, this is our Earth. Our Earth is not Republican, our Earth is not Democratic. We'll be able to make that change we want and progress together and at least try to unify our country, at least in terms of science, if not other things.
Anne, why does science matter?
One of the things with the global climate change, for instance, I don't think there's debate that it's happening. I think that the debate should be about what are we going to do about it? How are we going to handle it? Delaware we have a seashore, we have ports. If the oceans rise, that affects us. We're going to need to budget for changes for that. If we just decide that, oh no, it's not happening, and we're just not going to think about it, well, that's not a good plan.
Just again about it being a real Delawarean issue, we have huge factories all throughout the state. And we, like I said, my 8-year-old self could see these huge plumes and say, hey, there's something wrong with that. Maybe we should fix it. And I think with a huge positive of the march, and like I said, the silver lining of the whole volatility of the political atmosphere, is that now we're not just seeing it, but we're thinking of ways to progress. And science is so crucial. That's the mode of fixing, of innovation. And these issues, if we just push them aside and pretend they aren't happening, that's a huge tragedy of the commons issue. We don't want Delaware to become the state, the commons. We don't want Delaware to become that. I want my children to know what a glacier is. That's a concern for me. It shouldn't be a concern for me, but it is, especially living in Delaware. I don't want my children, my future children and grandchildren, to be scared of going to the beach. That's a current issue. It shouldn't be an issue, but it is. And those are the kind of things that the march is trying to target. And science is the facet for innovation, for improving. And that's why it's really important to have this march.
Thanks to Vaishnavi Kushtisharov, Dunya Ramadan, and Anne Green for their time this week. The March for Science kicks off at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Newark on Saturday, April 22nd. There will also be a march in Lewis, hosted by Action Together Delaware. And The Green continues next with our arts playlist. Stay with us. This is Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Forgeries are part of the art world. For every classic masterwork, there's also money and prestige in passing off a fake as the real thing. For our latest arts playlist, our Mark Earhart talked with curator Linda Eaton at Winterthur Museum about its newest exhibit that explores the world of forged art, Treasures on Trial.
Riding a crowded tram, I'm joined by a couple dozen passengers taking in what Winterthur is known for, the gardens. Spring's just settling in here, and soon vast swaths of color will dot the rolling hills. But inside the museum, color of a different sort hangs on the walls. Chances are you'd recognize much of it, but, well, that's the point. The art on these walls is fake. I met curator Linda Eden at the front of the exhibit.
This exhibit is Treasures on Trial, and it's set up. I see a lot of cork boards and case file graphics here on the walls. It's set up as kind of a Sherlock Holmes mystery.
Well, that's exactly it. It's really Treasures on Trial, the art and science of detecting fakes. And so we're really looking at the issue of fakes and forgeries. We're talking about the motivation and intent behind these forgeries. And then the history, the connoisseurship, and the scientific analysis that goes into determining whether something is fake or real.
And it seems to be hard because right off the bat we have what I think is a fake Rothko. It's...
Yeah.
I mean, this could be real for all I know.
Yeah, and so we love it having it here because it's so un-Winterthur-like. People don't associate with Winterthur with abstract expressionist artists. And this painting was featured in one of the biggest art scandals of the 21st century, the Nodler Gallery, which was a renowned gallery. It was one of the first, I think it was the first American commercial art gallery in New York. They closed because of a scandal surrounding a multi-million-dollar selling of fakes and forgeries to various clients. And this was the first piece that the woman who brought all of those fakes to Nodler, this was the first piece that she brought them.
And art law is something interesting in this country. It's not illegal to make a fake Rothko, right?
Right. It's only illegal to sell it and tell somebody that it's a real one. And that is a problem. In Europe, it is illegal to create a forgery. But in this country, you're usually done for wire fraud or some kind of connection to selling it. The creation of the forgery is not illegal.
But let's move on through here, through the crowd. There's a bunch of things in here, and it's not even just paintings.
No, I mean, we've got fashion, we've got a couple of Chanel suits, we've got Chinese export porcelain, we've got an Andrew Wyeth watercolor that has circulated on and on through the market many, many, many times until finally it was snaffled and taken off. This is a local story, of course, for us. Andrew Wyeth painted a portrait of Henry Francis DuPont and lived up the road and was very frequently here at Winterthur. But this is a good fake, but not a great fake. And Mary Landa, who is the Wyeth collection manager, had seen this and identified it as a fake when Andy Wyeth was still alive. But it went, you know, back to the person who had consigned it to auction, was sold privately, came back to another auction firm, disappeared, you know, was recognized as a fake, disappeared again, came out on the market again, and so now it's safely and soundly off of it. But, you know, one of the problems is that, you know, if someone buys a fake, you're out of pocket, right? You know, and so the temptation is to recirculate that and to let somebody else be fooled.
It's kind of like somebody buys a bad car. You don't want to tell the person you're selling it to that it's a lemon.
Exactly, exactly. This was the Andy Wyeth lemon.
And what makes this a lemon? Where's the bad transmission in this beautiful watercolor?
So this is the genuine watercolor, and so the distinction here is all through connoisseurship, and so this exhibition is strong on both connoisseurship and scientific analysis. And so when Mary Landa and Andrew Wyeth himself had this fake in front of them, they knew from the differences in technique that it was not his, right? And so it's that connoisseurship, that eye, that knowing eye, that knowing, being able to compare and articulate the differences and the problems, recognizing that something is not right and being able to articulate that and show that by comparison, that is part of the training to become a connoisseur. The connoisseur is like an old-fashioned term, but we've not come up with a better one in terms of really understanding, having experience and comparative material and really understanding the methodology and technique of an artist or a cabinet maker or whatever.
It's the expert knowledge, the person who has looked at a body of work and maybe can tell that something is just not right.
Right. And so, you know, the difference is that if you've got a pigment that was not used during an artist's lifetime, you know, that's like a smoking gun.
Now, I understand that there are some Tiffany lampshades and Tiffany lamps.
Yeah, this is a great story. Tiffany lamps are very, very highly collectible and make high, high prices on the market. And what we have here are some really superb fakes. In fact, we've got such superb fakes that we got one of them mixed up and only had to change it this morning.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at two lamps and they look exactly the same. I can't tell you which one's the fake. Which one is the fake, the one on the left or the one on the right?
So the one on the right is fake. The solder on the original Tiffany's tends to be lead-based, But the fakes that we were analyzing, and this doesn't mean that it's true for all fakes, the solder did not contain lead. And so lead is a very dangerous material, right? And so for crafting, people took lead out of that kind of solder so that you wouldn't, you know, hurt yourself. And so this one lampshade that was thought to be real doesn't have any lead in that solder, and so it is not right.
So walking through here, we've seen a fake Pollock, we've seen a fake Rothko. You have to have talent to be able to fool everybody in the industry, museum curators, private buyers, galleries in New York City. Is there a Picasso of forgers?
Oh, sure. But one of the real great and most prolific forgers of the 20th century was a guy called Elmer de Hory. That wasn't his real name. He also forged his name and was not what he all claimed to be. But he forged a lot of early 20th century art, Matisse and things like that. He was convicted of forgery, but committed suicide before he went to prison, leaving a large body of work, but also his palette. And that painting palette has recently been analyzed here at Winterthur by one of our graduate students working with our scientists. And the knowledge that they've gained from identifying the characteristics of the pigments and paints that he used is going to help us identify many of the forgeries that he committed that are still out there in public and private collections. He created thousands of forgeries, and many of them remain to be identified.
So do museums and collectors have to be more due diligent about vetting the pieces that they take in?
Yeah, you know, everybody should bring a critical mind. When you're collecting something, you can get carried away by your passion for wanting something so bad. You want it to be real. You know, it's really hard to keep a critical mind. It's also really easy to recognize a fake with 20/20 hindsight when we're trying to analyze it right now. And so people really need to be keep an open and critical mind. They need to be very humble about things, because we've all been fooled, and anybody who doesn't think they've been fooled is been fooled. And know that our knowledge is constantly increasing. So our knowledge of identifying these fakes is constantly increasing through improved connoisseurship and scientific analysis. Researching provenance is also a very key point. But the fakers are getting better at the same time, right? So fakes and forgeries have been problematic for centuries, and I don't see that changing anytime soon.
Now back outside among the rolling hills at Winterthur, it makes one appreciate the authenticity of nature, because these flowers and trees aren't fake. At least I'm pretty sure. I'm Mark Earhart.
Thanks, Mark, and thanks to Winterthur curator Linda Eaton for her time this week. The Treasures on Trial exhibit at Winterthur opened this week. It runs through January 8, 2018. And we wrap up The Green next with Enlighten Me, where we talk Blue Rocks baseball and the club's 25th anniversary. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. In April 1993, the Wilmington Blue Rocks brought minor league baseball back to Delaware. Since then, the club has consistently drawn fans to its Frawley Stadium home on the Wilmington Riverfront. And along the way, there's been a handful of Carolina League championships and early glimpses at major league stars like Johnny Damon, Carlos Beltran, Mike Sweeney, Eric Hosmer, and Salvador Perez. This week, the Rocks opened their 25th anniversary season, and in this week's Enlighten Me, we offer both a look back and ahead, starting with our conversation with Assistant General Manager Andrew Lehman, who's among those who've been with the team all 25 years.
Is it hard to believe it's been 25 years of Blue Rocks baseball?
Yeah, it really is. It's flown by. I really can't believe it. It's been my second lifetime, you know. Ever since I got out of college, this is where I've been, and it's really, really hard to believe we've gotten this is the point we're at.
Take me back to that first opening day. I know there was the rain that pushed it back a day, and then the incredibly dramatic victory in that first game. Just kind of take me back to like what you remember from that first day.
Well, I think everyone would probably agree it was complete chaos, controlled chaos, thankfully. But I think we got our CO for the stadium that afternoon at like 3 o'clock. we got everything done as best we could to be able to open for the people. The number of people that actually came, and the weather was so bad, they were lined up down the ramps into the gravel park. There was no parking lots. We had to bus people in. It was just crazy. It was crazy.
I know, people forget how while that whole off season was getting ready, that the stadium, because of the weather, wasn't on time. Just looking back at that, I mean, is it kind of crazy to think that it was that much of a whirlwind just to get this thing started?
Yeah, looking back on it, I mean, it's a true testament, really, to Matt Minker, who was the general contractor and a part owner at the time. And it was just, he just willed it to happen. And we had a great staff, a lot of young people, within their first couple of years in baseball. So it wasn't like a huge veteran staff, but everybody worked well together, and we just made it happen. And it was really Matt's will upon everybody to just make sure we were here and open up and ready to go that day.
You mentioned Matt Minker, and certainly what we see today after 25 years is really a testament to the vision that he had, not just that initial vision of getting the stadium built and getting the team going, but really the way he kind of crafted this organization during his time running it.
Yeah, Matt was a fantastic person to work with. Miss him every day. Fortunate to have his son Clark as part of the ownership group now. And Matt, like you said, Matt just created this vision that you were going to follow, and you just believed in him, and you never had any doubts that it wasn't going to happen. Matt always said it was going to happen, it was going to open, not to worry about it, and you just believed in him. That's just the kind of person he was.
Talk to me a little bit about maybe some of your fondest memories of Blue Rocks baseball. Is there a season or a memory or two that really just kind of, for you, are like, okay, this is what life in the Blue Rocks has been like over these 25 years?
Not particularly anything that stands out. The All-Star games are always fun. That 94 team, the first Carolina League championship, that was amazing. We had a heck of a run from 94 to 99. They won four championships. So that was pretty neat. Those are some really neat times. Some really, really good players, good teams. And it was fun. It was fun. It still is fun, but back then it was, you're witnessing it for the first time. That 94 season was just magical.
You mentioned the players. I mean, and we've seen so many great players come through here from those first years where you saw the John Liebers, the Johnny Damons, through the Mike Sweeneys to the Eric Hosmers. Just your kind of thoughts on the players who've come through here, and are there ones that maybe for you really kind of defined what this organization's about?
I think the one player that really defines what this organization about is probably Mike Sweeney. He's just so well liked. He's such a nice person. He comes back. He still remembers people's names. He's still in contact with his host family. His spirit and his attitude, and it's just contagious. When he walks in the room, he smiles. He makes you smile, and he's just friendly. He's just a family friendly guy, and that's what this place is all about. And Mike just embodies that spirit.
You mentioned the host families, and people know that the attendance here has always been very, very strong. But you also have this kind of community support as well with host families and through other things that the team does in the community. How important has that been to have that kind of ongoing community support to get to 25 years?
Oh, it's huge. Without it, we wouldn't be here. There's plenty of minor league cities that the market kind of just dried up because the community support isn't there. And we're fortunate to be in a great community. Wilmington and the surrounding areas have been wonderful to the team. We're going on our 25th year of a host family program where all the players stay with local families. They don't have to live in apartments. They don't have to find their own places to live. And it's worked out great. That's coordinated by an individual named Bill Mitchell, who's volunteers to do it. And he does a fantastic job of placing players with the families. And it kind of gives the players some ownership in the city, too, because they're living with families instead of just being in a hotel and going back and forth to the ballpark every day. That kind of ingrains them into the community, too.
Is there a reason you think, or maybe reasons you think, why the team has had such a successful connection to this community? Again, not only through the host families, but just the year in and year out attendance that you guys see.
I think a lot of it is being the only, other than this 87ers, but for the longest time we were really the only professional sports team in Delaware. And it was something for people to call their own. Delaware kind of sticks to themselves, and to have the Blue Rocks here, I think, was important to a lot of people in the community. A lot of the business, I can't thank the business community enough for the support they've given us over the years. And I think just being Delaware's only team, that's that's kind of the draw to the community. I think people take pride, a lot of pride in that. It's not Philadelphia, it's not Baltimore, it's actually Delaware's own thing.
Is there something you point to with pride about what this team has done in the community or what it's meant for the community that you can look at and say, like, you know what, this is what we're all about?
I just think it's the family side of it. You know, you see people now who came here as kids who now are bringing their kids. And when we first got here in 93, it was the same thing. It was grandparents bringing their grandkids, you know, that had come to the old ballpark at Governor Prince. And so it's kind of nice. It's all about the family atmosphere. And it's nice to, you see people in the community like, oh, I love bringing my kids there. It's a great place to go. It's fun. I can let them run around. It's safe. So that's what is most important to us, that we're a family-friendly place. And I think we've been able to maintain that. And I think the community appreciates that.
Thanks to Blue Rocks Assistant General Manager Andrew Lehman for his time. Now we turn to Rocks play-by-play man and Media Relations Director Matt Janis for a look ahead to what fans can expect in this 2017 season.
This organization prides itself on being a fun family atmosphere. Is there a little bit more incentive going into this 25th anniversary season to kind of really, you know, drive that home with fans that, you know, here we are and we've been here for 25 years and we're glad that you keep coming out and watching these games?
Yeah, we take a lot of pride with the success we've had over the last quarter century, and one of the things that we talked about with consistency during all the planning sessions in the off season was, let's make this a special year. It's a silver season, 25 years. Let's make it a season-long celebration. So we've really tried to put things in the promotional schedule over the course of the year that fans will enjoy and that'll just kind of remind them that we've been a part of, for many of our fans, most of their lives now at this point.
One of the things you guys do have scheduled is having some names come back from the past, some blasts from the past. Can you give us a little hints of who might be showing up at the ballpark this year?
You know, that's still kind of up in the air. We're with the baseball schedule, so many people are still working in baseball that, you know, we feel like we have a date, and then all of a sudden that date doesn't turn to work. So the idea is to get some people back, but we're going to honor people over the course of the year. That's going to be a big part of what it's going to be. We're also doing a bobblehead series over the course of the year, which is something new this season. We've always done bobbleheads in the past, but this year we put together six, and they're actually going to come together into one commemorative item. So if you come out to every game, they will turn into one keepsake to represent the 25 seasons. It's six of our best players, and it's just something that I think we partner with Bank of America on, that people are really going to feel special and take back some of the memories when they leave with a bobblehead keepsake.
Are there some other things you're doing promotional-wise or giveaway-wise that try to connect people to that 25th anniversary?
So every Saturday, we're going to wear the throwback uniforms. We're bringing back the throwbacks this year. One of the things we always hear from the fans, how much they love those original jerseys. So on Saturday nights at Fraley Stadium this year, we're going to be in the throwback jerseys. And we're also going to wear them on other special nights as well. And it's going to feel like 1993 inside the ballpark. Then we're going to bring back all the season ticket holders who have been here all 25 years. They're going to get honored on the field before the game. So we're really looking forward to that, because we wouldn't be here without those folks. Our game staff, believe it or not, we have people that have been on our game staff, just hourly employees that have been here all 25 years. We're going to honor those folks on the field before the game. And just over the course of the season, on different Saturdays, we'll have people throw out first pitches that have been part of the community, and, you know, partners, advertising partners, groups that have been coming out for 25 years, just to reach out and make sure they know how much we appreciate them, and to be honored in front of all the fans. That's going to be a big hallmark of what we do this year.
Out of curiosity, how many season ticket holders are there that have been here the whole 25 years?
You know, that's been the most interesting thing about it, is the back and forth with people of, well, were you here all 25 years? Did you miss it for a year? But it looks like it's somewhere in the neighborhood about 25 to 50 people were here all 25 years, and then hopefully about 10 to 15 of them are going to be able to make it out. If you have that kind of dedication, I mean, that's 70 games that we're talking about basically every night, every other week. And to have that kind of dedication to the Blue Rocks, boy, we can't thank them enough.
You do have some other promotions that aren't necessarily tied to the 25th anniversary. Just tell people about some of the other things they can expect this season at the ballpark.
Well, you got your hallmark at Fraley Stadium. The Cowboy Monkey Rodeo is back. We were the place that found it in minor league baseball, brought it to the baseball field. It's one of our most popular promotions. The fans ask about it every year. We're bringing it back five times this season, record-setting number, so we're really looking forward to that. The other thing that we're doing for another season is the Mega Candy Drop. Our owner, Dave Heller, one of the members of the ownership group, he actually invented that rep out in Idaho. We bring a helicopter over the field, and they drop candy in the outfield, and then the crowd will kind of go scatter and try to pick up the candy and take whatever they can get. So that was a really popular one. That's back by popular demand this year.
And obviously there is baseball, too. Tell us a little bit about your thoughts on the team that you see and what Blue Rocks baseball may look like on the field this year.
You know, I'm really excited about it. Last year was kind of a transition year. The Royals have been so successful over the last 5 or 6 years, and after putting all of their attention towards the minor league side and their prospects and building it up, I mean, the Royals had the best system in minor league baseball for what seemed like 3 or 4 years. Their attention went to the major league side. So you know, the product was a little rougher, but this season there was kind of that gap that's been filled in. I think there's going to be a lot of talented players, a lot of guys that you're going to be seeing play in the majors in a few years, and you get that sneak peek. I think people really appreciate that I saw that guy when, and you'll get plenty of opportunities for that this year.
Thanks to Blue Rocks play-by-play man and media relations director Matt Janis and assistant general manager Andrew Lehman for enlightening us this week. For more on the Rocks' 25th anniversary season, including game tickets, head to BlueRocks.com. And that's a wrap on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website and on iTunes and the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributor Eileen Dalabrida, Delaware Public Media's Mark Earhart, James Dawson, and Katie Pikus, as well as our president and station manager, Casey Houts. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.